As fires rage in California, farm workers are continuing to labor amid the smoke.
Whether the air was unhealthy, whether there was smoke in the air, whether there was ash falling from the sky, not working was simply not an option.
I'm Arun Vanigopal in for Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Wednesday, September 9th, we break down the working conditions for farm workers amid the devastating fires. Then, how calling the police during mental health crises can lead to deadly consequences.
What we'll often see is the person shouting or lashing out or running away, but they're running from things that they alone are seeing it. And that can come across to the police, to other people, as this person is acting threatening, when in fact that person is just frightened.
Also, school discipline amid the pandemic and the effects on students of color. And we wrap up the show talking about colon cancer, the disease that took the life of actor Chadwick Boseman. But first, the workers who pick our produce amid fire and smoke. California wildfires continue to burn, and the state is currently under a red flag warning for strong, gusty winds and low humidity.
We are just coming off a record week, a heat wave that led to 130 degree temperatures, the highest temperature ever recorded in California, arguably the world's history here in our state. The hots are getting hotter, the dries are getting drier. Climate change is real. If you are in denial about climate change, come to California.
That's California Governor Gavin Newsom during the Democratic National Convention a few weeks ago. And on Sunday, he declared a state of emergency in five California counties. And farm workers in California are especially vulnerable. The people harvesting the fruits and vegetables, those helping keep the country fed. They continue to work despite COVID-19, despite heat waves and the wildfires, making the air smoky and really hard to breathe. Recently in Sonoma County, the fires were so severe that evacuation orders were placed and some residents were forced to leave their homes. But farm workers stayed. The Sonoma County Evacuation Waiver Program allowed the Agricultural Commissioner, Tony Liniger, to dole out access passes to the farm workers to ensure they'd continue harvesting the grapes, even in evacuation zones. For most farm workers, not working is not an option. Many are undocumented and without insurance. And the choice between safety and work is really not a choice at all. No work, no pay, which leaves thousands in dangerous conditions right now. Breaking down working conditions for farm workers is where we start today on The Takeaway. Here with me to discuss is Somini Sengupta, the international climate reporter for The New York Times. Somini, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Arun.
You actually went to California and you spoke with farm workers there. Can you tell us about the farm workers that you met and what they're experiencing right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was there recently to the San Joaquin Valley, which is in the center of California. It's this long, wide valley that's turned into largely industrial farmland. And that's where the grapes and the carrots and the lettuce, the watermelon, the pumpkins, pretty much everything the rest of the country eats to stay healthy. That's where much of it is grown. So one day when I was there recently, by noon, temperatures had soared past 100 degrees Fahrenheit near a town called Lodi. And I met a woman named Leonor. She was working in the cherry orchards. The harvest was done, and Leonor and a group of other women were there to clear the branches that had been hacked off the trees after the harvest. They needed to clear the fields before the pesticides could be sprayed on the fields. And you know, the Valley Air Pollution Control Board, the government air pollution agency, was saying that the air was unhealthy. By the end of that week, the Air Pollution Control Board was telling everyone to stay home. But Leonor was still working every morning. She was out there still working. And I asked her, and she said, well, if we stay indoors, we don't get paid. We've got bills to pay. Leonor and her husband have three children. They're in school. They rent a house in the town. Air conditioning bills are extremely high for them this summer. And so for Leonor, and many other farm workers I spoke to, whether the air was unhealthy, whether there was smoke in the air, whether there was ash falling from the sky, not working was simply not an option.
And what's extraordinary about this, to me at least, Somini, is the fact that these are what you might call first responders. They are providing food that we all depend on, right?
They are essential workers. They are out there picking weeds and preparing the fields and harvesting the crops and fixing the irrigation systems and essentially everything that we eat to stay healthy. Those five almonds that you eat every day, or the grapes, or the cherries, the tomatoes that go into our meals, they're the ones who are harvesting those crops every day. And they're doing so at a time when climate change is making heat waves hotter, more frequent, more intense, and when wildfires are spreading across just vast areas of California. So millions of acres of California are on fire, have been on fire for the last few weeks, as we all are seeing. And farm workers are continuing to work in the fields.
I spoke to my sister the other day. She lives in Marin County, basically the Bay Area. And I'm always used to it being a little chilly, a little rainy. She told me it was 108 degrees there. Now, this, where you were, is basically a few hours east of San Francisco and the Bay Area, correct?
Yes, it's east and south. So this is inland. It's a valley that's nestled by two mountain ranges. It's essentially between the Bay Area and Los Angeles. And I drove down that valley from the north to the south, speaking to farm workers in the fields.
I remember spending some time there years ago, and it was really hot. And that was well before these conditions that you're describing. So it's basically getting even hotter and even drier. And these are the people who have to deal with this on a daily basis.
It's already hot in the valley, but summer days are hotter than they were 100 years ago in California. That's what the data shows. Even worse, summer nights are hotter. And that's really important because that's when the body has a chance to cool down. So if you can't cool down at night, or if it's harder to cool down at night, it can actually be very, very dangerous for our health. Additionally, the valley is where wildfire smoke, whether it's coming from Northern California or Southern California, it's where the smoke always gets stuck. But now that so much of California is on fire, when fire weather days have essentially doubled in frequency since the 1980s, this part of the state, the Central Valley, just has many more days of really, really unhealthy air. So for farm workers who are exposed just by nature of their work, the work is just much more hazardous.
So tell us about the health risks that these farm workers are essentially confronting, the fact that they're breathing in this smoke on a daily basis. So what does that mean for their health?
Right. So even when the government air pollution officials are advising everyone to stay indoors, farm workers are still outdoors working. That is their workplace. So chronic exposure to air pollution, and I just want to add that not only does wildfire smoke create unhealthy air, like really unhealthy air in the Central Valley, there's also just the pollution coming from trucks that are whizzing down the highway. There's pollution coming from the chemicals that are sprayed on the fields. And there's also, in parts of the valley, there's oil wells pumping oil. And that creates air pollution as well. So parts of the Central Valley have some of the highest rates of asthma and other respiratory diseases. There's also something very specific to the valley. There's actually a disease called valley fever, and it's a respiratory ailment that comes from fungus in the soil. And agricultural workers are disproportionately exposed to this as well.
What kind of protections, if any, do these workers have in terms of pay protections or health insurance, anything like that?
So that's a really good question. The California is unique in the country. It's one of two states, along with Washington, that actually has extreme heat protections built into its occupational safety regulations. So that means that agricultural workers must be offered water, shade, breaks during really hot days. But there is no cutoff. There's no threshold at which, temperature threshold at which work must stop. That really remains at the discretion of contractors and employers. And when I was speaking to the workers, they made it very clear to me that if they were forced to stop working because it was extremely hot or because the air was unhealthy, they were not going to get paid. And they were not going to be able to pay the rent and buy food. So the underlying economics of their working conditions really force them, compel them to work under hazardous, unhealthy conditions. They, by and large, lack health insurance. And so preventive health care is kind of a luxury. Many of them end up in the emergency room when they get really sick. And they lack basic protections that that many of us have, which is, you know, unemployment benefits. If they're not working, if they're not able to work, they don't get paid.
And we're, of course, also in the middle of a pandemic. Have there been outbreaks amongst farm workers?
Central California counties have especially high rates of coronavirus infections. And there have been a spate of infections, particularly in processing and packing plants. Everyone I spoke to a person, knew someone who had been sick. So either a coworker, an aunt, a relative, a neighbor, everyone knew someone who had been sick. And there have been, just as in meat processing plants in the Midwest, in nut packing processing plants, in fruit and vegetable processing plants, there have been infections because, you know, workers are in close proximity to one another. I should add that generally when there are really bad wildfires and there's smoke in Central California, there are efforts made to get masks out to farm workers. This year, masks have gone out a little bit later than they should have because there's a real, you know, there's a run on N95 masks.
You quote an official from United Farm Workers of America who says all these conditions that you've described, the conditions that farm workers have to deal with on a daily basis, even during a pandemic and even during these terrible wildfires, he says it's the price of cheap food, which I found really telling and kind of tragic, given that these are essential workers and they are keeping us fed. Is there anything that you think needs to be done or should be done, given that this is increasingly an annual phenomenon and we all rely on this food nationally, but these are the people who are bearing the brunt of these conditions?
The economics of cheap food and climate change are colliding on industrial farms. And the ones who are paying the price are some of the poorest, most neglected, most marginalized workers who happen to be overwhelmingly immigrants from Mexico.
Price of cheap food. Somini Sengupta is a climate reporter for the New York Times. Somini, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Several recent events have placed more public scrutiny on how police respond to emergency calls about people with mental illness. Yesterday, we took a look at Daniel Prude's case, a black man killed by police in March while suffering a psychotic episode in Rochester, New York. Protests broke out in Rochester last week after body camera footage was released, showing police holding a hood over Prude's head to prevent him from spitting. Prude died a week later from asphyxiation. In an update to that story, the entire police command, including the chief, have resigned. And in Salt Lake City last Friday, 13-year-old Lyndon Cameron, who lives with Asperger syndrome, was suffering a mental breakdown when his mother called 911 for help. Police responded to the call and shot him multiple times in his home. He is now in serious condition. These cases are continuing to spotlight police interactions with people who have mental illness. According to the Treatment Advocacy Center, a person with severe mental illness is 16 times more likely to be killed in an encounter with police. With me is Alisa Roth, a mental health reporter at American Public Media and the author of the book Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. Alisa, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
We hear terms like psychotic or mental breakdown to describe people, including Daniel Prude and Lyndon Camera, and these terms tend to sound pretty alarming. What does an episode like that typically look like?
It can present in a variety of ways. Often the person will be hearing voices that nobody else can hear. They'll be having hallucinations, so seeing things that aren't actually there. And for the person who is experiencing this, it can be a really frightening moment. And so what we'll often see is the person shouting or lashing out or running away, but they're running from things that they alone are seeing. It's not real threats. And that can come across to the police, to other people, as this person is acting threatening, this person is presenting a danger to me, when in fact that person is just frightened and trying to protect him or herself.
In many of these cases, and this is just an ongoing problem, you have men and women with guns who show up and who, as you just explained, don't necessarily know how to deal with these situations. Why is this the norm in so many American cities?
It starts with the problem that we have nobody else to respond to a mental health crisis. So if, heaven forbid, my house is on fire, I know to call the fire department. If my neighbor is having a heart attack, I know to call the ambulance service. But if a person is having a mental health crisis, very, very often it's the police who respond. And the police have been called on for, it's been decades now that the police have been called on to respond to a mental health crisis. But for the most part, police have very little training in how to deal with this. Police are instead trained to respond as if this is a public safety emergency, and respond accordingly.
Are there other options for them besides calling the police? Or what should the options be instead of calling the police in a better world?
You know, it's interesting because this is a place where the people who say we should defund the police and the people who say we absolutely should not defund the police really come together and say police officers should not be the ones responding to a mental health crisis. It should not be a police officer who's trying to talk somebody down if they're threatening to hurt themselves. It should not be a police officer who comes when a mother calls because her 13-year-old son is having a mental health crisis and runs off. There are various approaches that different departments have taken, different cities have taken. So in some cases, now we're starting to see police officers being trained. How do you respond? How do you de-escalate the situation? How do you talk somebody down from this moment and convince them to, whether it's drop the weapon or go to the hospital? We're seeing police departments that have teamed up with a mental health professional. So the person, you call 911 because your loved one is having a crisis, and a social worker and a police officer may be dispatched. In a few places, we're actually seeing just the mental health professional being dispatched. But in many, many cases, we're just seeing the police respond, and they shouldn't be.
As you mentioned earlier, a person with severe mental illness is 16 times more likely to be killed in an encounter with police. You know, there's no breakdown there in terms of race. Presumably, this is even worse for people who are Black, who also are dealing with mental illness, correct?
Absolutely. We know that Black people and Black men in particular are much more likely to be shot by the police. And the flip side of that is that a police encounter a white person having a mental health crisis, they're much more likely to see that as a mental health crisis and that this person is in need of help rather than that this person is a threat. And so absolutely, it is much more likely. We see, you know, roughly one in five fatal police shootings involve a person with mental illness. That said, I've seen many, many fatal police shootings of both white people and black people. And I think that the problem is that people with mental illness are being seen as a threat by the police. And again, that police are being called in to respond to a situation that they're not prepared for, that they're not trained to do.
I've seen figures from the past saying that Cook County Correctional Facility, Rikers Island, these jails tend to be some of the biggest mental health facilities in America. Is that correct?
It is true that they are among the largest providers of psychiatric care in this country. People with mental illness are much more likely to end up in the criminal justice system. They're much less likely to make bail, and those who do make bail are much more likely to sit for a longer time in jail while they're waiting to come up with the money. So that means that you have many more people who are sitting in the jails with mental illness. On the prison side, they're much more likely to get sentenced, so much less likely to get a plea bargain. They're much more likely to get a longer sentence, and they're much less likely to make parole or good time or all of the things that could get them out sooner.
Alisa, we talked about the disproportionate number of people with severe mental illness being shot or injured. Do we see something similar when it comes to incarceration rates for people with mental illness?
By some estimates, as many as 50% of the people who are locked up in the jails and prisons in this country have a mental illness. That's a much, much higher proportion of people than in the general public.
I mean, is it even possible to get decent care if you're behind bars?
Well, as you probably know, people in our jails and prisons are the only Americans with a constitutional right to health care, and that includes mental health care. So they're guaranteed health care that is equivalent to the health care that they would get in the outside world. Unfortunately, the courts have left it up to the jails and the prisons and the states to decide what that looks like. What does it mean to have equivalent care? And so in many, many cases, the treatment that they're getting is minimal. And the other part of this is that jails in particular, but prisons as well, are terrible for people. They're terrible for everybody, let's make that clear, but they're particularly bad for people with mental illness who need routine and calm and steady care. And I've heard psychiatrists refer to jails as psychotogenic, as, you know, inducing psychosis. They're loud, the lights stay on all night, people are concerned about their safety. So there may be a sense of paranoia that's actually quite legitimate. Am I going to be attacked? You know, we have this public perception that people with mental illness are dangerous, when in reality, we know that the people with mental illness are much more likely to be victims of violence rather than perpetrators of violence.
Within correctional facilities, within jails, within prisons, are they ever separated from other parts of the population?
Yes, in particularly the larger jails and also the state prison systems will have a special mental health unit where somebody with severe mental illness may be sent, both so that they can get care and so that they can be separated and protected from the general population. The problem is that very few people are quote unquote lucky enough to get sent to that mental health unit. So I visited the inpatient unit in the LA County Jail, and you know that was like winning the lottery if you could get sent there, because it was quieter and you were going to get the care that you needed. But there are so few beds available that really very few people would end up getting sent there. What's much more common is that somebody with mental illness is being disruptive because of their disease and are sent to solitary confinement, which is the absolute worst of the worst for everybody, but absolutely for a person with mental illness. We know, in fact, that solitary confinement can trigger symptoms of mental illness in people who didn't even have them before.
Alisa Roth is a mental health reporter for American Public Media and the author of Insane, America's Criminal Treatment of Mental Illness. Alisa, thank you for joining me.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
As schools reshape their learning environments to keep people safe during the pandemic, many districts have also been forced to rethink their disciplinary policies. Those changes range from figuring out how to respond when students take off their masks in the classroom, to deciding what to do when a child is being disruptive over Zoom. In the past, school disciplinary policies have been administered unequally, with Black students punished disproportionately, according to a 2018 report for the U.S. Government Accountability Office. Native American students and students with disabilities are also punished at higher rates than their peers. Now, some education experts are concerned that the new protocols being rolled out during the pandemic could deepen disparities in school discipline. For more, I am joined now by Kaylin Belsha, a national reporter for Chalkbeat. Thanks for being here, Kaylin.
Thanks so much for having me.
Prior to the pandemic, what were some of the types of policies leading to disparities in how discipline was carried out in schools?
Well, before the pandemic, we saw disparities happening at kind of all levels of discipline. So it wasn't necessarily one kind of policy, but for sure, the kinds of policies where there was some kind of discretion involved in figuring out whether or not the child should be punished, we saw a lot of disparities there. So that could be figuring out, was a child defiant or acting out in class? Were they not following the rules, being disobedient? We saw from researchers and studies that we know that those have contributed greatly to racial disparities and to Black students being disproportionately punished for the same kinds of behavior as their peers who wouldn't be punished for those kinds of things. But then we also saw big disparities in out-of-school and suspensions as well as expulsions, which are more serious behaviors used typically.
Right. And now we have millions of kids returning to schools in some form or another, an incredible amount of anxiety on the part of parents, and I'm sure kids as well. But disciplinary policies are not something that have gotten as much attention. What are some of the new disciplinary policies that schools are enforcing for, at least for in-person learning?
For in-person learning, probably one of the biggest changes that parents will notice is around their child's behavior when it comes to social distancing and also wearing a mask. So we've seen several school districts make failure to wear a face mask something like a dress code violation, which is usually addressed by having the child maybe go to the office, having a talk with them, maybe taking them aside. But if the child repeatedly does not wear a face mask, those dress code violations can stack up into something more serious that could end up in the child being removed from school and being made to learn online.
We're seeing it's not just being removed. There's actual possible consequences in terms of the criminal justice system.
Yes, there's at least one state we've seen that could make it something like a misdemeanor, and it could be a criminal offense. Yes.
Based on what we already know about disparities in how school discipline is carried out, what are some of the red flags in the new policies that schools are introducing?
Something we've seen in several codes of conduct is that it has called attention to the fact that they will try to figure out the child's intent in what happened. So that we've seen around mask wearing, as well as spitting, coughing, or sneezing on a classmate, that it will come down to whether or not the child intended to do so. And we know in the past when subjectivity has been laid into discipline codes that it hasn't turned out well, especially for Black students. So I think a lot of advocates right now are concerned that we're going to be trying to figure out, did the child intend to do these things, and who will be the one perceiving whether or not the child intended to do it. So there's just a lot of concern there about how that will play out.
All right. We asked you about your children's experiences with discipline in schools, and we heard back from several parents of students with disabilities. Here's what one mother in Oregon told us.
He has ADHD and autism spectrum, and the discipline that he experienced at school was to be shut in a small room in the office and was kept there for the almost entire 6 hours of school. It happened day after day at the school. And because of their inability to deal with him and to accommodate his special needs, we are homeschooling him entirely for the 2021 year school year.
This is Michael from Fargo, North Dakota. My son is a child with some slight sensory seeking behavior in autism, and we've had a couple disciplinary experiences at school. He was placed in the principal's office with nothing to do for about 20, 30 minutes, and when you have a child with sensory seeking needs, you know that is a recipe for disaster, and we got a call to come pick him up because he found a marker and was trying to kind of draw on the wall. Follow that up with another time we went in to see what was going on, and as we entered the office, because he tried to make a tape backwards around his fingers for some sensory needs, he was being disciplined, and we found him in the fetal position on a chair with a teacher standing over him, growling at him, poking him in the belly, because our office staff are being asked to help provide monitoring for special needs students when they have a disciplinary action. And without any of the training that goes along with it, they're making some very poor decisions.
Kaylin, were some of the concerns mentioned by our callers similar to what you've heard from other parents?
Yes, actually very similar. The parent who mentioned the child with ADHD, I have talked with parents whose children's learning disabilities affect their ability to pay attention for long periods of time. And so they're very concerned about both the in-person or the at-home learning if they're on a screen for a really long time. We know a lot of school districts are really upping the amount of live virtual instruction that will be required this year. So parents are concerned about, well, what if my child can't pay attention for long periods of time? Could they be disciplined for that? And then also in person, there's going to be just a lot of restriction of movement and maybe not the same ability to leave the classroom or move around. So whether or not the schools will provide the kinds of breaks that children will need, and children who have sensory needs, I've also heard parents concerned about, what if my child can't wear the mask for long periods of time? So there's just a ton of concern coming from parents of children with disabilities right now.
Now, you reported how in Utah, students who don't wear masks at school could potentially be charged with a misdemeanor. I'm wondering, how common is it for criminal charges to be brought against students who violate school codes of conduct?
Well, before the pandemic, students were certainly arrested for behaviors that happened at school. And again, that almost always disproportionately was done to Black students. Often they were for the kinds of things that you might expect, more like bringing a weapon to school, getting into fights, assaulting a teacher or a classmate. But right now we're seeing what we would normally consider to be small misbehaviors carrying much higher consequences. Something like wearing a face mask could be considered a health risk. So I think what concern advocates have told us about is that, you know, these smaller things being treated like much, much more serious ones, which for good reason, we understand there's a health concern there. But what does that look like in practice and how does that get carried out?
And there are certainly connections between something that might seem as innocuous as being disciplined in school and something much more serious, which is the school to prison pipeline, right?
Right, correct.
Erica Washington is a former teacher and she's now a colleague of yours at Chalkbeat. She called in and shared this with us. Regarding discipline.
We are already seeing stories of kids being punished for small incidents, like the story that just came out about a seventh grade Black boy with ADHD getting suspended for 5 days for having a toy gun in virtual school in Colorado. Now the boy has a record with the sheriff's office in his county and a mark on his disciplinary paperwork. Teachers and administrators, you can avoid this. This Black boy will remember this for the rest of his life, and his record will follow him. Please, please think about your actions during virtual learning, because the consequences will last forever.
Kaylin, suspended for 5 days for having a toy gun in virtual school. This, I don't even know what the word to use. This sounds quite surreal or Orwellian. I mean, this gets us into this whole other kind of, I guess, area of virtual discipline in virtual schools, which seems to be an entirely different situation from the problem of teaching kids in schools.
That's right. We're seeing some school districts adopt kind of addendums to their student code of conducts that are supposed to govern virtual behavior. And when can a student be, for instance, muted in a classroom if they're being too disruptive, which is something advocates are worried about. You can't mute a child when they're learning in person. When could you remove the child from the Zoom classroom and put them in something we've seen are these kind of supervised studies is something that the Memphis School District is using, where the child would be supervised by a virtual teacher. Maybe they'd be with other children, or it could be more like an in-school suspension, but they're in a virtual in-school suspension where they have a separate folder of work that they'd be doing during that time. We've also seen districts like Chicago make tweaks to their existing student code of conduct that would govern when is it okay for a principal to block a student's access to the online classroom. And there's some language in there. It's kind of vague. It says it should be restored as soon as possible when the safety threat is over. But when I asked and said, you know, if a student loses access for the full day, is that a suspension? They said no. And advocates said they're very worried about that because if we're counting it in a different way, it just makes it very difficult to figure out what's happening. The data may not be as transparent. So people are just watching to see how are these things classified? Are they suspensions or are they not?
Kaylin, in 20 seconds, is it possible to keep people safe in schools without enforcing such strict codes of conduct?
I think so. A lot of advocates have told me, you know, places are being proactive. They're still finding ways to implement restorative approaches to discipline, making sure that the intervention is more about helping the child than punishing them. I definitely think that there is a way to do it. It's just going to take a lot of work collectively from everyone.
Kaylin Belsha is a national reporter for Chalkbeat. Thanks so much, Kaylin.
Thanks for having me.
Last week, actor Chadwick Boseman died at the age of 43 after a four-year battle with colon cancer. He was a hero on and off the screen, especially for kids of color, perhaps best known for bringing to life Black Panther. His death shocked celebrities and fans alike and put a spotlight on colon cancer, the second leading cause of cancer deaths in the U.S., and as with so many diseases, colon cancer is one that disproportionately affects the Black community in this country.
Black men have a 24% higher chance of getting colon cancer than white men and a 47% higher chance of dying from it, whereas Black women have a 19% higher chance of getting it and a 34% higher chance of dying from it.
Dr. Charles Rogers is an assistant professor at the University of Utah's School of Medicine and associate member of the Huntsman Cancer Institute. He's been studying this health disparity for years. For him, this issue is also personal.
So it was in the fall of 2009 that my aunt, Joanne, was misdiagnosed 3 to 6 times before she was diagnosed with stage 4 at 52 years of age. So for those who may not be aware, colorectal cancer, with screening, stage 0-1, you have a 90%+ chance of survival. But stage 4, like my aunt, less than 10%.
Dr. Rogers says there's not one thing that explains why Black people, like his aunt, are at greater risk. There are several possible factors at play, including rates of screening for colon cancer.
It's estimated that 19% of the mortality disparity between Black men and women is attributed to lower screening, 30% of that being lower stage-specific survival. In my personal opinion, I would imagine that it relates to some of the things that are risk factors for CRC, whether it be, you know, being obese or a lack of physical activity, you know, smoking, alcohol consumption regularly. These are the areas where Black men specifically tend to be in the top. So I would say that those are potential factors, in addition to poor patient-provider communication, fatalism, racism. Family history is definitely a factor that should be considered. Generally speaking, if you have a family history of colorectal cancer, you should get screened at age 40 or 10 years before the individual in your family that got diagnosed.
What are the most common symptoms of colon cancer, the things that people need to be looking out for?
Yeah, so a few include a change in bowel habits that lasts for more than a few days. So this could be diarrhea, constipation. Definitely if your stool the size of a pen or a pencil, that's not normal. Feeling that you have the need to have a bowel movement, yet you aren't able to do some. Bleeding from your rectum, dark stools, blood in your stool, long-lasting cramping or belly pain, fatigue, as well as unintended weight loss.
Are there any lifestyle changes that people should consider in order to minimize or lessen the chance of colon cancer?
Absolutely. Individuals can work on reducing their smoking. They can improve their diets to make sure that their diets aren't high in fat or of red or processed meats. They can become more physically active. Those are some of the key things to consider.
And how often does someone need to get screened?
So how often someone gets screened depends on the type of screening that they have, as well as the recommendation for their provider. So, you know, the best screening is the one that gets done. But in terms of screening, if you get a stool exam, those are less expensive. Those are definitely something we can consider in light of COVID, you know, for individuals who may not be comfortable going to a provider yet. You know, you're simply taking a smear of your stool and you can do this in the privacy of your own home. It's less invasive than a colonoscopy. But with this type of exam, individuals have to get it annually. Whereas the gold standard that most individuals hear about is a colonoscopy, that, you know, may be the case that you have to take that every 10 years. But depending on what your provider finds, or if you have a family history, it could be that, you know, you're actually recommended to take one every 3 years. It just depends.
So you have some pretty innovative approaches, how you get out there in the community and have these conversations. Tell us a little about that.
If you think about all the medical mistrust that is stemming from historical things that have happened in history, whether it be Henrietta Lacks or the Tuskegee study, for me as a community engaged researcher, it's very, very important for me to go where the people are. So one of my key studies is called Cutting CRC, like cutting hair. And CRC is an acronym for colorectal cancer. And so this is really focused on developing a barbershop-based intervention on masculinity barriers to medical care. A number of psychosocial factors, including knowledge, social support, attitudes, those social determinants of health we may take for granted, such as if you have health insurance, if you have a job, where you live, et cetera. And I'm doing this work in Utah, where I'm based, Minnesota, where I have done quite a bit of work previously, as well as Ohio.
Barbershops are really kind of a safe space for a lot of people who gravitate to them, maybe week in, month out for years. What have you learned over the course of doing this work that you didn't necessarily know when you started out doing it?
I'm bald now, so I don't have hair. But prior to having hair, you would go to the barber weekly, bi-weekly, and barbers tend to have an average relationship with their clients of about 7 years. So that being considered, barbers may know more about their clients than their significant other, or if it's someone younger, you know, their mother or father may. So for me, the barbers have a lot of power in their hands where they can really influence behavior change each and every time they connect with their clients. So if we think about it, as it relates to colon cancer screening, which can be a sensitive topic, barbers can really, really potentially make a change in the individual's behavior. We also think about the culture of a barbershop. It's a safe place for men. It's very key to also think about other races you can reach the people. In light of COVID, we've had to be very strategic in terms of being really aggressive with using social media, whether it be Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn. But ultimately, to me, you have to get the feedback of the community in terms of the best way to reach people. Like if you look at any of my marketing materials, you'll see that my face is on there. And that's not because I'm trying to publicize myself, but it's because the community informed me that, you know, for example, in Utah, there's never been a black male doing this type of work. So it's very key for the community to see my face everywhere, because that can definitely build rapport and trust in the work that I'm doing.
When we consider racial health disparities in general, what are the problems that we can most immediately address?
We have to have policy in place such that providers who are aware that, you know, we as blacks get the disease earlier in a more advanced stages, they can be more aggressive in recommending screening, even if it's not what is actually recommended. Providers definitely need to take the time to be more genuine and or take the time to actually build rapport with their clients, specifically black people, considering the mistrust that I've mentioned earlier, which is rampant in the black community. So those are just a few recommendations that I have.
Dr. Charles Rogers is assistant professor at the University of Utah School of Medicine and associate member of the Huntsman Cancer Institute. Dr. Rogers, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
Earlier in the show, we broke down how discipline in schools can have a negative effect on children, but some of those effects can also be long-lasting.
This is Chris from San Diego. When my daughter was in fourth grade, she was made to stand and was shamed by the teacher in front of the whole class for a bad test grade. She's now in 10th grade, but the experience soured her on school ever since. She's a smart kid, but is happy to learn remotely now, as she no longer enjoys classroom settings and finds them stressful. Before fourth grade, she was very outgoing and social.
We always appreciate hearing from you. If you have more thoughts to share about school discipline or really any story at all, give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We may not be able to air every call on the show, but we do listen to every single one. And that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening. We know the summer is coming to an end and we're heading into fall, and it's been kind of a strange year. Thank you so much for listening and spending your days with us. If you missed anything or want to hear any of our stories back again, visit thetakeaway.org. You can also tweet me at ArunNYC. That's ARUNNYC, conventional American spelling. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Van Gopal in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. We'll be back with you tomorrow.